Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the main event in New Jersey, the Super Bowl, which should be a moment for Governor Christie to be basking in the spotlight, but instead he is likely to be seen lurking in the shadows as the deepening political scandals surrounding him show no signs of abating. Salvador Rizzo, who covers New Jersey state government for the Star-Ledger, joins us to discuss charges by Christie's former close aide that the governor knew about the bridge closures while they were happening, and Sal Rizzo's latest article at the Star-Ledger, Bridge Scandal, When Did Christie Learn About the Lane Closures? Then we will look into the corporatization of the Super Bowl as private and corporate jets pack the nearby Teterboro Airport, and the bulk of tickets for today's events are way beyond the reach of average citizens. Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, formerly with the New York Times, David K. Johnston, joins us to discuss the Broncos versus Seahawks game at MetLife Stadium as a celebration of corporate power and privilege, with luxury suites up to $1 million, complete with private chefs and climate control. Then finally, we'll examine the latest political and economic crisis in Argentina, where there is a run on the banks with the peso in free fall and people lining up for blocks to buy dollars, while President Cristina Kirchner is all but AWOL, to the point she is seen by many as a mad queen, out of touch with her people and possibly out of touch with reality. Robert Cox, the former editor of the Buenos Aires Herald, who has been called the hero of Argentine journalism for risking his life to report on kidnappings, torture, and the murder and disappearances of thousands during the dirty wars of the 1970s and 80s, joins us to discuss the latest self-inflicted wounds to a country rich in resources and talent. Joining us now is Salvador Rizzo, who covers New Jersey state government for the Star-Ledger, where he just wrote the article, Bridge Scandal, When Did Christie Learn About the Lane Closures? Welcome to Background Briefing, Salvador Rizzo.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. And I think the title of your article gets to the heart of it, doesn't it? I mean, the latest twist and turn in the Chris Christie saga has come from his former friend, who is obviously in trouble, who ordered the lane closures. His lawyer has indicated that Christie knew about it, not necessarily before, but certainly during the lane closure. And in his big mea culpa when the scandal broke, Christie went out of his way to say that he didn't know anything about it before or during. And I find that hard to believe. Wasn't it a big news story, the fact that the main connection between New York State and New Jersey was having such monumental problems?
You know, traffic is a fact of life over here. It's a commuter state, New Jersey. Everyone is constantly traveling. So I don't think it immediately became this huge mystery why there was this big jam on the George Washington Bridge. But after a couple of days, you know, that's when people started to say, okay, something is up here. And by the time it first got into the press, you know, the lanes had already been reopened. So, you know, it's something that did take a little while to really gain the public's attention. But the question, like you said, is, you know, at this point, when did the governor learn about this? You know, Wildstein is making a very explosive allegation. David Wildstein is, like you said, the official who closed the lanes and, you know, was an official at the Port Authority, who was there on Christie's blessing. And he's alleging, you know, very seriously that the governor is lying, basically, that he lied throughout this two-hour press conference. He is seeking immunity from prosecutors, and he is seeking the Port Authority to pay his legal bills. So some people are taking his allegation with a grain of salt. But then again, you know, we won't really find out until there's a court involved, there's a prosecutor who can tell us, you know, what really is going on.
Well, it seems to me that Christie's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. If he has the reputation of being a kind of hands-on, no-nonsense guy who gets things done, and his entire defense is that somehow this massive traffic jam, he had no prior knowledge of it, and he had no knowledge during it. So when does he actually claim that he first had any knowledge? When does his sort of apologies end? At what point did he acknowledge what was happening?
Well, that's why we wrote that article today, because the governor has given a public statement on this on three separate occasions, two press conferences and a radio interview. And in each instance, he has said something slightly different from the previous instance. You know, he started off saying that he first learned about it from a leaked email that appeared in the press from Patrick Foy, the executive director of the Port Authority. That email appeared in October in the Wall Street Journal. And then subsequently, the governor said it wasn't in October, it was in September from various press reports. And he said, but it was an evolving thing, you know, when I learned about it. And then on January 9, at his two-hour press conference, he sort of stepped back from the Patrick Foy email, and he said there was a story earlier than that. But he hasn't been able to really pinpoint, you know, when he discovered that these lanes were closed and or when it came to his attention. And his spokesman just says, you know, well, it was in a press report, and the first press report came out on this day, which is, again, sort of a vague answer.
Well, when did he make that joke about he was out there with the cones?
That was at his very first press conference on the issue on December 13. And on that occasion, he said, you know, this is a traffic study. I don't get involved in traffic studies, and that's all I ever heard about it.
Well, isn't that a bit of a whopper, though? I mean, I've never understood for the life of me what kind of a study you would do on traffic by causing such gridlock. And what were you studying? Has anybody asked that simple question?
Well, I mean, at this point, I think the traffic study is pretty much, you know, has been exposed as a cover story from David Wildstein and some others who testified before the assembly. You know, Bill Baroni, another executive who was appointed by Christie to the Port Authority, he gave a presentation at an assembly hearing with charts and statistics about Easy Pass users. That's like a quick commuter pass so you can avoid paying tolls. But, you know, when the traffic study, quote-unquote, showed up in subpoenaed documents, it was just a PowerPoint presentation that concluded TBD. And Port Authority officials from the New York side at this bi-state agency, they all seemed to cast cold water on the theory that it was a traffic study. They said, this is not how we conducted. This is not something that anyone else at the Port Authority was informed of that would have been involved in the traffic study, and they seem to find that explanation really suspect.
Again, I'm speaking with Salvador Rizzo, who covers New Jersey state government for the Star-Ledger, where he just wrote the article, Bridge Scandal, When Did Christie Learn About the Lane Closures? So I guess, though, your state should be celebrating now. Everybody, the eyes of the world, if you will, are going to be on Rutherford, New Jersey this afternoon or this evening at 6:30 p.m. Eastern time for the Super Bowl. And it obviously is a moment, would normally be a moment for the governor to be basking in the limelight. And he was in New York yesterday at an opening ceremony for the Super Bowl and got booed. What do you think is likely to happen today?
I think today will be a very, very low-key day for the governor. He still will go. It sends the wrong message, I guess, politically, if you start to back down from public commitments and events. But yeah, I don't think the governor had ever been booed like that in any public setting. You know, he's widely been, you know, praised and celebrated in New Jersey as he goes around to various towns to give his famous town halls, you know, events and stuff. You know, people are constantly asking for his autographs and posing for pictures. He's been on the cover of Time magazine, I guess, twice now. This is something that he's not accustomed to, and you could see it in his face from the photographs. You know, he was frowning. He was visibly upset there on the stage with Andrew Cuomo and Jan Brewer and the NFL officials. And you got to think, you know, these weren't just New York people at the event. These were tourists from all over the world at Times Square yesterday. So, you know, the word is getting out very quickly about this traffic scandal, and I don't think anyone is looking too kindly at the governor, even though nothing has linked him directly to the scandal yet, or you know, possibly at all.
So, Salvador Rizzo, will we be seeing pictures of him behind the glass, like they show pictures of the owners of these teams, you know, way in the background? In other words, he's not going to be front and center in any news coverage.
But you're right. I mean, the interest in him will still be very intense. Every move that he makes will be monitored, and I bet you there will be those glass pictures somewhere in the newspapers tomorrow. He was at, just on Friday night, the day after David Wildstein made this bombshell accusation, he was at Howard Stern's birthday bash at the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York. And reporters were there, you know, cameras were there, and he just waved them off and beelined into the event. Joan Rivers roasted him about it. She said, you know, hey, how is the traffic getting in? He introduced John Bon Jovi, who sang, Wanted Dead or Alive, and, you know, all kinds of little details now are just redounding back to the traffic scandal wherever the governor goes.
Well, but it's one thing. It's a bit of a fall from grace, isn't it, to be the tough guy, no-nonsense guy, or even to the point where he's been described as a bully, to be the butt of jokes. That's quite a downfall, is it not?
That may be, you know, as much as the bad headlines for him keep trickling out every day, that may be something a bit more serious for the, you know, the general audience that is maybe not as plugged into the daily developments of the bridge scandal, but they do watch Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert every night. That's something that won't help him at all to be constantly on these late night shows as the butt of jokes.
And again, Salvador Rizzo, who covers the New Jersey state government for the Star Ledger, where he just wrote the article, Bridge Scandal, When Did Christie Learn About the Lane Closures? What's happening with the other scandal then involving the mayor of Hoboken? That sort of became a he said, she said. Has it gone beyond that?
I think it has gone somewhat beyond that. First of all, it is a he said, she said, as you said, although the mayor says, Don Zimmer says that, you know, she has witnesses who can corroborate her account that she told immediately after these conversations in which she claims she was blackmailed. And the U.S. Attorney's Office has started some sort of inquiry into this. Subpoenas have gone out. The mayor announced also Friday, just for you to get a taste of how, you know, all-consuming this has been, also on Friday, the U.S. Attorney's Office sent a subpoena to the city of Hoboken. And so it's still ongoing. Parallel to that, or alongside all of this, a little bit of a political kerfuffle has erupted in Hoboken. Some people in the city are now accusing Don Zimmer of having extorted them in a similar fashion and filed a lawsuit against her. And she's defending those accusations at the same time that she's leveling charges against the governor.
But wasn't there a story that broke as well that indicated that Governor Christie, because the whole point was Dawn Zimmer, and the case that she tried to make was that she asked for, you know, several hundred million of money from the fund after the Superstorm Sandy wrecked her town. I believe 80% of Hoboken was underwater. She asked for funds and ended up getting something like $100,000. At least that was the last report I heard, instead of the hundreds of millions of dollars. Whereas a report came out recently that some mayor who had in fact endorsed Governor Christie, his town was hardly affected, but he got money. Is there anything to that story?
That was something that was reported in the Star Ledger last week by a colleague of mine. The town of Belleville had a senior center that hadn't gotten off the ground until Governor Christie released $6 million from these community development block grants that are meant for Sandy relief and recovery. At the time that they announced this grant and that the project was finally going to get built, it was always couched in terms of keeping seniors in the town of Belleville. It was never really said, you know, oh, we're doing this to help Sandy victims. Now, at some point down the line, so that, you know, the link could be made to these Sandy funds, a couple of press releases mentioned kind of as an afterthought that Sandy-affected residents might be able to move into these units. But it does raise the question, as you said, Don Zimmer requested $100 million or thereabouts, and she has received so far $342,000. It's slightly different, though. You can't really compare the $6 million to the $342,000 because there's a pool inside that federal money reserved for development, which Don Zimmer obviously is refusing to do in Hoboken, and there's a pool for just straight-up projects, relief and recovery projects, which I guess is a little narrower in this instance.
So a colleague of yours, Bob Engel, of course, wrote a book about Chris Christie, and he refers to New Jersey, I guess, politically speaking, as Soprano Land. And, of course, there were lots of jokes about, butter, bing politics when this story broke because of the sort of suggestion that this was about sort of retribution mafia style. How fair is that description? I mean, obviously, The Sopranos were an incredibly popular series and, frankly, a quite fascinating one. But is it a slice of life or is it larger than life?
It's a little hyperbolic to me. You know, no one is ordering hits or dealing drugs out of the governor's office, you know. But I think the comparison illustrates that, you know, we are a rough state. You know, we do take things, you know, very close to the vest, and, you know, there's a lot of intrigue always going on in political circles at the town level, at the school boards, you know, at the state government, et cetera, et cetera. But listen, you know, this appears to be a huge traffic jam on the first week of school that was motivated just, you know, in the middle of a campaign season for political retribution. I don't think that is ever justified, no matter how rough the politics are, wherever you are, you know?
Well, I think that's why he's always been in trouble with this story, because it's something that people get immediately, you know. It just, you know, makes no sense. And if you're trying to justify it as a traffic study, then nobody's buying that, surely. I mean, is there any way, do you think, I mean, he did that long press conference, as we mentioned earlier, where he did all kinds of contortions and convolutions, where he apologized and apologized and apologized, but do you think at any point he can say something that would get this behind him? Because this has all of the earmarks of that drip, drip, drip that we recall from Watergate. You know, I mean, it's pretty clear that he's not getting his hands around this thing.
I don't know whether he can say something, but, you know, the governor hasn't been linked to any of this directly. Now, the secondary question is, if the governor didn't know, but many of his senior aides and top appointees at the Port Authority did know, including his campaign manager, his two-time campaign manager, his deputy chief of staff, and, you know, the official who ordered the lanes closed, David Wildstein. You know, where's the account? Where does the buck stop? You know, and is he, you know, is he really doing his due diligence managing his staff? That sort of question, I think, could come back to haunt him. And I think back to the 2012 Republican primary. Those guys play rough. You know, just like in Jersey politics, I mean, that Republican primary was pretty tough. You know, they were going after each other every day, very hard, in the debates, you know, in the media. And if you picture Christie in that scenario, you know, it's likely that, you know, a lot of people, you know, he's already feuding with Rand Paul. He was already, you know, enmeshed with some, you know, problems with Newt Gingrich. Will they remember that, and will they affix themselves to these charges of bad management, even if the governor is exonerated? I think so.
So it ain't over. Another, the fat lady hasn't sung, right?
No, not yet.
Well, Salvador Rizzo, I thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Salvador Rizzo, who covers New Jersey state government for the Star-Ledger, where he just wrote the article, Bridge Scandal, When Did Christie Learn About the Lane Closures? We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the corporatization of the Super Bowl.
Let me wrap my legs around your mighty rims and relieve your stressful condition. You got Wall Street master stuck cheek to cheek with blue collar truckers, and man, I really gotta take a leak, but I can't. I'm stuck in Governor Chris Christie's fault. Lane, New Jersey traffic jam.
The grocers, though we have fun. Tax collectors getting closer, still we have fun. There's nothing surer. The rich get rich and the poor get poorer. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, who's a professor of law at Syracuse University and the president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, an education organization with 4,200 members. A 13-year veteran of the New York Times, he won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. And he has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States. He wrote the best-selling books Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, and his latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. His forthcoming book is Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston.
Well, glad to be here, Ian. And by the way, IRE has now grown by another 500 members. We're over 4,700. So even though journalism is shrinking, IRE continues growing.
Well, so does the price of tickets at the Super Bowl. Now, I'm beginning to think, David, that we are revisiting the Roman Empire here, where in this big Colosseum where the gladiators, who will all be getting brain damage as they beat the hell out of each other today, are being watched largely by the patricians in their private luxury suites that now go for up to $1,019,000. And meanwhile, the ticket prices for regular folks, the cheapest tickets in the stadium, are going for $2,096. So I can't imagine that there are any average folks in that stadium.
Well, only if they won a promotional contest somewhere. That's exactly right. And one of the things about those tickets, when they're bought by businesses, as most of them are, either for the executives to bring top customers along or as a reward for employees, they're tax deductible. So you want to buy a $1,000 ticket to a football game. If it's a company, you get a tax deduction for it worth $350 from the federal government. But if you're a citizen, you've got to earn that money and pay it out of the after-tax income. And for most Americans, that means it's going to cost you around $1,300.
So we've already seen, at least I've seen on television news, clips of Teterboro Airport, which is quite close to the East Rutherford MetLife Stadium, absolutely cheek to jowl. They're charging a surcharge to park your jets there. So with these luxury suites with private chefs and climate control going for over $1 million, you have to also add to that the extraordinary costs of the hotels and the parties. And interesting enough, David, the Vince Lombardi trophy itself, for the winner, whether it be the Broncos or the Seahawks, is made by Tiffany. So,
well, yes, they're not going to do anything on the cheap here. What, you know, understand, the entire commercial sports business in the United States is very heavily a taxpayer-subsidized business that takes from the many and gives to the few. Of all the new stadiums that have been built in recent years, and you know that there's so much eagerness for this, that the Atlanta Braves are going to leave their 17-year-old stadium for a new one that the Tea Party Republicans in one of the outer counties are willing to build for them, an astonishing indication of how this isn't really about low taxes with the Tea Party people. It's about making sure the rich mine the rest of us. So 79% of the cost of new stadiums paid for by the taxpayers, massive other subsidies that go to these sports in various ways, those private boxes, and the only two professional football games I've ever been to in my life were in a private box, and it was belonged to a business where, you know, it's a tax-deductible expense because he brings clients to these things. This is part of one of the reasons so many Americans are struggling, is that the 1% of the 1% have been reaching into our pockets and forcing us to give them money. And let me tell you how bad ticket prices are. The Broncos and the Indianapolis team, the Colts, had a game in October. The average ticket price was $464 to that game, and the cheapest ticket was $167. That's just astonishing. This is for a game of just a game. It wasn't the Super Bowl, and at this game, the cheapest ticket costs more than the most expensive Super Bowl ticket did about 7 or 8 years ago.
So, what does this have to do with the game itself in terms of the fans, the people who actually watch football? I guess they all watch it on television because they simply can't afford to watch it.
People watch it on television, and it's important to the football leagues, the owners, that they keep the large television audience so they can keep shifting these costs. You know, there's a proposal before a federal judge now for the league to pay out, in round numbers, $750 million to deal with brain injuries to football players. And Joe Namath just gave an interview where he says, you know, I have brain trouble. The human body is not built, not any part of it, for football. The real costs of those injuries are going to run billions of dollars. But if the football teams get away with this, if the billionaire owners get away with this, you and I will pick up the cost of what's really workers' compensation claims by these workers. And this is all part of this enormous cost shifting and tax shifting by billionaires. And if you're listening to this, if you haven't called your congressman and your state representative and your mayor, if you have a team, and said, stop these subsidies and talk to your neighbors about it, then you haven't done anything. And just listening to the show is a waste of time if you don't do something about it.
And again, I'm speaking with David K. Johnston, who's a professor of law at Syracuse University and the president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, an education organization with 4,700 members. A 13-year veteran of the New York Times, he won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. And he has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States. He wrote the best-selling books Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch. And his latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, and his forthcoming book is Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. So this game today and the various luxury suites and all of this stuff that we've been talking about, David K. Johnston, you've also got to add to the tab here that these over this weekend, and particularly in New York, there have been these A-list parties. DirecTV had a Super Bowl Saturday night party on Pier 40 in New York, hosted by Eli Manning, featuring 6,000 high-end revelers and entertainment by Jay-Z. And then Playboy rented the Bud Light Hotel on a cruise ship that's parked there in New York. And that's got to cost some serious money. Is that all of that stuff tax deductible?
Yep. As long as the company shows that it is, as the law calls it, a reasonable and necessary, ordinary and reasonable business expense, then it's all tax deductible. And all these companies arrange this as marketing. And furthermore, remember that the IRS's auditors have been handcuffed by Congress. Now, when a company is audited, a big company, there is an agreement in advance on what will be audited. Only the things that are agreed to can be examined. Even if the auditor finds awful things going on, they're not allowed to pursue them. And the company knows in advance what's going to be looked at. Now, compare that to the inspection of pet shops, which are done on surprise because that's how you find out things. I mean, we have complete regulatory capture under President Obama and before him, the two previous presidents of the Internal Revenue Service. It has been turned into an agency that does the bidding of the people it's supposed to be auditing, and it's a terrible, terrible policy. And, of course, Congress is cutting the budget of the IRS so that even if somebody is cheating on this, they're not going to get nailed. It's not going to happen.
Well, no, the last so-called scandal, which the Republicans, inflated over some minor IRS official looking into the legitimacy of the Tea Party as a 501c3, that they managed to turn that into a persecution of the Tea Party. So
yes, and amazingly, Ian, the guy who ordered the careful inquiries of these applications was a self-described conservative Republican who's a career IRS guy. And the way to think about this non-scandal scandal is as follows. Imagine you're the building inspector of your town and somebody presents you plans drawn on, you know, with crayons by a child to put up a multi-story building. You know, you're going to immediately say, I'm sorry, we have to investigate this. Well, the request that they got for tax exemption screamed on their face, we don't qualify. And both liberal and conservative groups were scrutinized. There's no question that some of the conservative groups were more heavily scrutinized because their applications were so completely inappropriate. And the only groups who had their status taken away were liberal groups. So this is a complete non-scandal. This is complaining that the building inspector is doing his job to make sure that buildings are safe and sound. But it's typical, unfortunately, and this is a really bad thing about this. You know, the Republican Party, instead of being the responsible party of fiscal conservatism and, you know, restraint against new ideas, has turned into the party of manufactured scandals, of transferring money to the wealthy and of harming the economy whenever it is not in their political interests.
So, David K. Johnson, the other aspect of the Super Bowl, apart from my analogy to the Roman Colosseum and the patricians basically having all the seats and the plebeians being shut out and the gladiators on the field getting brain damage, there is also this obsession with security. I don't know whether you've been following the news coverage, but that seems to be – is that just the way we are today because of this post 9/11 paranoia that any big event, our focus is on security as opposed to what the event's about?
This is an unfortunate development the founders warned us about can happen. You know, when the British had bombings at Harrods, which is the premier department store right in London, an unbelievably fancy place, they didn't shut down all of their society and take away everybody's civil liberties. They recognized that there are bad people who do bad things, and they address them. But we, unfortunately, have developed this awful mentality. And one of the best explanations of the expression of it is a book by a libertarian named Radley Balco called The Rise of the Warrior Cop, where he goes through why the police are becoming more and more militarized, why we're having more and more of these incidents of overreaction. And it is this appeal to our fear rather than to our strengths. You know, there's always been terrorism. There are acts of terrorism described in ancient documents like the Old Testament. There will always be people who will commit violence because they don't see any other way to make their political cause. But you don't throw away your liberties and your individual freedom because, yes, a few of us will get killed. If I end up dying because some idiot blows up the plane I'm on, then I end up dying, but I shouldn't give up all my liberties because that might happen. That's absurd. And yet that's what we're doing. We're seeing politicians appeal to our worst fears because it strengthens their position and discourages us from doing what we're supposed to do in our democratic society, which is challenge and question and hold accountable our representatives in our government.
Well, back to the Super Bowl in terms of the game itself, it seems to me that it has evolved from a kind of, you know, of course, they, you know, used to have leather helmets, and you see those early Army and Navy games on television, and now the sounds of the people hitting each other, the absolute impacts that you see sometimes are just horrendous. You wonder how these people ever get up after they hit.
I think that just as boxing came under serious assault because it was inherently unsafe, we're slowly beginning to see the same thing about football. And the rest of the world, of course, other than Canada, plays soccer, which doesn't involve nearly the risks that football is. We know that football is an inherently damaging sport to the athletes who participate in it, and yet we continue to pour subsidies into it. We continue to denigrate education at many of our colleges so that we can support teams, you know, right to the extreme example of what we saw in Penn State, where we cover up for a child serial rapist in order to protect the football team. And this is a terrible expression of what's gone wrong with American values.
Well, but it also seems that more and more the focus is on owners and coaches and whether they get fired, you know, and you see these poor mea culpas from these coaches, you know, and that all seems to me to be kind of an expression of sort of laissez-faire capitalism, you know, that everybody's expendable, and you always see the owners behind the glass in their remote luxury suites. And they always, the camera always goes to them. Is that what's happening now? Because, you know, this plutocrat in Silicon Valley made these absurd comments about how the 1% are now being scapegoated like the Nazis scapegoated the Jews. And you get the feeling that these people are living in a completely different planet. And
here's the important thing about Tom Perkins, the guy who said this, who he says he's not a billionaire, by the way. He did go through a divorce, and maybe that explains it. If he hasn't earned after tax well more than $1 billion in his lifetime, given that he's at the premier Silicon Valley venture capital firm, he's really not a very good businessman. He should have earned well north of $1 billion by now, over his lifetime. But we don't know, because, of course, that's not public record. But, you know, the 1% of the 1% are being criticized, not for having money, but for not bearing an appropriate part of the burden of making America thrive and endure in the long run. And then turning this into, oh, I'm a victim. I've got $1 billion or hundreds of millions of dollars, but I'm a victim here. And, oh, they're thinking about class warfare. We have class warfare in America. We've had it for years. Warren Buffett has pointed out, we have class warfare. It's being waged by those at the top against people down below. And as Buffett said, my side is winning.
Or has won. just in closing then, David K. Johnston, of course, the other aspect of it is how much the media makes out of it. I mean, a Super Bowl ad, a 30-second ad, costs $3.8 million. So apparently Fox is going to make $380 million.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not the media. That's one outfit. It's Rupert Murdoch's Fox Sports that's doing this. Let's be clear. That's a highly concentrated benefit. But everybody else covers it, because something like 100 million Americans, one out of three of us, is going to watch this football game tonight. I'm not. I'm going to the supermarket because there's no line at the store. But if people want to watch football, they want to watch football. And what we should be concerned about is you and I, who, if we don't watch it, shouldn't have to subsidize it with our tax dollars, which means we're forced to subsidize. And Ian, can I just make one comment about the thing? Yesterday,
very briefly, yeah.
About Christie.
Yeah.
Okay. If David Wildman is not believable, if he is a completely disreputable person, as the governor says, why in the heck did the governor appoint him to this minimal work, six-figure job at the Port Authority? We need to pay close attention to matching up what politicians say over time to their statements. And at one time, David Wildman was so respected, he got this important plum post. And now, because he's saying something that is damaging to the governor, you know, he's a totally disreputable person. Well, then why'd you appoint him?
Well, David, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Take care.
Again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnston, who's a professor of law at Syracuse University and the president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, an education organization with 4,700 members, a 13-year veteran of the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize for reporting uncovering loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. And he wrote the best-selling books, Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, and The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And he has a forthcoming book on inequality. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how Argentina is run by a mad queen. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is the award-winning journalist Robert Cox, who has been called the hero of Argentine journalism as the editor of the English-language Buenos Aires Herald during the dirty war of the 1970s and 80s. He risked his life to report kidnappings, torture, and murder of thousands of Argentines by the military government. For his courage, Cox was awarded the Maria Moores Cabot Medal from Columbia University and was appointed officer of the Order of the British Empire for services to international journalism. He's the subject of the book Dirty Secrets, Dirty War, The Exile of Robert J. Cox, written by his son David Cox, and he is now a columnist with the Buenos Aires Herald. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Cox.
Thank you. Great pleasure to be talking to you.
And I take it you see Argentina as very much your country. Or
we spend roughly half the year there, 4 to 5 months a year. Because our family, we had to go into exile, so our family is split up. We have just one son living in Argentina, and the other four children are with us here in Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina. But we spend every winter, or I sometimes like to think every spring. So we have two springs or two winters, whichever way you look at it, in Buenos Aires. I'm very much involved, and I write a column for the Herald, which I used to edit.
Well, so we thought your country was out of the woods, but apparently not. There's a run on the currency. The president, she seems to be absent without leave. The New York Times carried a story a couple of days ago that was fairly dire in the sense that it seems to be sort of politically and economically leaderless. Is it that bad?
Yeah, I think it is that bad. It is that bad. And it's been a slow slide, a gradual process, which, to my mind, is very similar in some ways to the way in Argentina during the when people started to disappear. You could actually see people being picked up off the streets, and it was fairly common knowledge what was happening, but people managed to ignore it. Argentina did very well for the first 5 years of the last decade when Nestor Kirchner came in, largely because they had a tremendous return from exports, particularly soy, selling to China, and the country was for a while awash in money, which the government did some good things. They brought in a child payment to pay for children and done a number of things like that. But at the same time, under Cristina, it has become something like as if the country is run by a mad queen. And over the New Year and Christmas, she didn't even say to the people of Argentina, you know, happy holidays or happy New Year. She had some medical problems, but she's had them from time to time. She came back with a will a little while ago, and then now she seems to have vanished. She's tried to reshuffle her cabinet, banishing one of the most unpopular members of her team, a man called Moreno, who ran the economy like as if he was a mafia boss. He used to bring people in and businessmen and shout at them, and it's become quite chaotic there. And then over on top of that, immediately after the Minister of Planning announced that there would be no problems with power cuts, which tend to happen in very hot Buenos Aires summer, and there were massive power cuts and thousands of people without water because there was no electricity. We have a friend, 86-year-old friend, living on an eighth floor. She relied on neighbors bringing her buckets of water, and she was out of power for something like 2 weeks. Other people have been out for months.
So
it's a very sad situation, extremely sad situation. It seems to happen about every 10 years. Argentina seems to collapse.
Well, there have been, of course, there was a period of Menem where he appeared to be looting the country.
He was.
And her fortunes have increased while the country's fortunes have decreased. Is she still in Cuba?
No, she's back from Cuba. It was a strange visit. She came back and then she had a minor medical problem and went to hospital when she came back and then got very angry with the press for reporting it. But we still have the impression that she's not running things completely. And so you have contradictions all the time. One minister says one thing and another minister says another thing. And, you know, then there is the problem once again of corruption in Argentina. It's come very much to the fore. The president herself, Cristina, has managed to increase her wealth while she's been in office by about 10 times. And she's a tremendously large landowner in the south now, and there are many, many questions raised about her fortunes.
Again, I'm speaking with award-winning journalist Robert Cox, who has been called the hero of Argentine journalism as the editor of the English-language Buenos Aires Herald during the dirty war of the 1970s and 1980s. He risked his life to report kidnappings, torture, and murder of thousands of Argentines by the military government. For his courage, Cox was awarded the Maria Moores Cabot Medal from Columbia University and was appointed Officer of the Order of the British Empire for services to international journalism. He's the subject of the book Dirty Secrets, Dirty War, The Exile of Robert J. Cox, written by his son David Cox. So given the history here of Perón and his various wives and then Menem, as we mentioned, looting the country, and now this mad queen, as you described her, who seems to be AWOL at a critical moment when there's a run on the banks. What explains the dysfunction? Because this is ultimately a very rich country, with, you know, endowed with natural resources and talented people. So why is it so dysfunctional?
I think it's a problem of identity. There is always the feeling that of Argentines have that they're at the end of the world. And it's quite interesting that now Argentina has an Argentine pope, Pope Francis, and when he appeared at the balcony, he said, "I'm a man from the end of the world." Of course, mass communications have changed all that, but Argentina has not managed to establish its identity. And what we're seeing now, too, not, of course, thank God, with murder, torture, and everything that we had to deal with under the military government, but at the same time a tremendous polarization between the right and the left, with the media cut in two, so that it's very difficult for the average Argentine to get the truth about anything, because they have to choose very often between black and white, and when they choose white, they stay with white and believe white, and when they're with the other side, they'll believe everything from that side. And that makes it very difficult for the country to reach rational decisions, completely sort of bipolar in that way. And unfortunately, Cristina reflects that, because she has completely changed her policies on a number of things. From the point of view, she said there would never be a devaluation, and of course they devalued 8% over a month. The peso has gone from when we were there from 1 or 2 years ago from 4 to 12, which is on what they call the blue market. Don't like to talk about the black market. This, of course, has led to enormous amount of speculation and straightforward profiteering on the exchange market.
Well, in effect, her mismanagement has fueled the black market, hasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah, because people, it's a terribly sad sight to see. And to talk to friends, there are queues of people outside the bank waiting to be allowed to buy small sums of dollars, which has to go through the FEIP, which is the equivalent of the IRS. It's the tax, and everything has to be approved by them. People are so desperate that the dollar for them means some kind of comfort for their retirement.
So, Robert Cox, what about, I don't know whether one can psychoanalyze a country.
We've often tried to do it. In fact, I used to write that what the country needed, if there was such a thing as somebody that did psychoanalyze countries.
Well, if one were to, wouldn't you first of all come to the conclusion that this is still a wounded country? I mean, there aren't too many, in quotes, civilized countries that turn on themselves in the vicious way that the Dirty War did, where a group of its citizens murdered another group of its citizens without any compunction whatsoever, and in the most unbelievably brutal way.
No, exactly. That is, and I've often used that expression, it is wounded, and that's one of the explanations. There are many, many reasons. And it is fairly simple to work out what went wrong in Argentina, and what went wrong was in 1931, when the military came in, staged the first coup in a country that was very progressive at that time, was very rich. The rate of economic growth was outpaced that of the United States. The army came in, and they never really left until the end of this appalling dictatorship from 1976 to the end of 1983, in which the military discredited themselves finally when the Argentine people woke up, when they went to war over what the Argentines call the Malvinas and the British call the Falkland Islands, and it was such a resounding defeat for the military that they slunk back to their barracks and have made a few attempts later on to undermine democracy, but they seem to be out of the picture at the moment. But even in that situation, Cristina, as we all call her, made an incredible. She chose as the army commander-in-chief, essentially the commander of all the three forces, a man who is charged with causing the disappearance of a young conscript. This is General Milani, which was an incredible thing to do, when perhaps the greatest thing that this government did was to bring these military monsters, and that is not an exaggeration, they were monsters, to trial, finally. And that, of course, has wounded the country. It's a country with a wounded psyche, a country that hasn't yet managed its identity. At the same time, it's going to get things right sooner or later. The people are wonderful people. As I said, it's a psychological case. I think you hit it very well. We have more psychologists and psychoanalysts, more shrinks in Argentina than any other country in the world, particularly in Buenos Aires. And Buenos Aires itself might be a bit of a problem because it is so overpopulated. And the rest of the... We traveled down south, and it's just extraordinary to see this incredibly fertile country and beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And, of course, it's so different from the rest of Buenos Aires. It becomes a fascinating place. One becomes fascinated by it.
So is there any sense, then, of a way out, given the history of these recurrent looting and dysfunctions that destroy the economy, that it slowly built back because it's inherently a wealthy country with natural resources and, again, the talented people? You would think that having the Argentine Pope may have been a shot in the arm. I mean, is there any... I don't want to be too pessimistic here, but... Is there a way out if you got an absentee landlord here who, as you described earlier, as the Mad Queen? That doesn't sound particularly encouraging as long as she's around.
No, I think, the answer is democracy. Argentina has to have the patience to put up with another 2 years so that she finishes her term, which hasn't happened for a long time. The military government came into power when they could have allowed Perón's widow to continue for a little while longer. No, it's the important thing is democracy, working with and respecting the rules, respecting rule of law. It will come gradually, but this is going to be the test. The next 2 years are going to be the test of Argentina. There's no reason why they shouldn't pull through economically. The country has enough, although reserves have been enormously depleted. There's no reason whatsoever why Argentina should not be able to get to 15 and elect another government. And I think that this country has a possibility to become a very fine country in every way.
Well, the irony, of course, of the Falklands or Malvinas War was that it took Margaret Thatcher, in effect, to get rid of this horrible military government. And is there any possibility that any outside forces could affect things? You know, we have here in the United States, I remember recently covering one of these vulture capitalist funds that are going after Argentina's debt. It sounds like there are still, you know, sort of outside predators as opposed to those that want to help.
Well, they're called the vulture funds here, and Cristina was very hard on them, but then she decided that she was going to repay them. She was going to pay them. I don't think... Argentines like to think that they are the victims of a malignant forces outside, and this just isn't true. It makes them feel more comfortable about it because it enables them to, you know, to transfer the blame to other people. And Argentina has got to get over all those things. I mean, again, using your term, I mean, it needs to sort of lie down on the couch and pour out all its grief and all its worries and all its megalomania about Argentina being this victim and of the outside world, and sort it all out and get back to the business of holding elections on time and then respecting democracy, respecting the law. The Supreme Court is reasonable now. For many years, the Supreme Court really institutionalized corruption. There are many things to believe that things will get better. The thing is, they have to get better in a real way, not in an artificial way. This government has tried very hard to use propaganda to convince the people that they're living in the best of all worlds. For a long time, Cristina would tell Argentines that the world was collapsing around them and only Argentina was strong. She said, "We are armored against what is happening in the outside world." Again, very similar to the methods used by the military, who used to actually create their own newsreels to convince Argentines that the world outside was violent and Argentina was, I'll use the words they use, it was an oasis of tranquility in a troubled world.
But that's not going to come back, is it? The military. I mean, you may have
a delusional leader in
Cristina.
That might, in fact, bring all Argentines together if the military tried to, because I think then the vast majority of Argentinians would rise up, as they nearly did when the military under Raul Alfonsín, a fine man and a good president, but he had to leave early because he was undermined by the trade unions and, of course, by continual problems with the military staging little uprisings, little rebellions. At that time, the people, I think, of Argentina, he decided not to. He wasn't going to risk. And so he came to terms with the military and agreed that he would not pursue trials against them. And so the people sort of stepped down. But I was in Argentina at that time, and the people would have gone to the military, and I think it would have pulled everybody together. Argentina has chances again and again and again. And I remember once an economist correspondent came, and he said, Argentina is like a poor little rich boy or a poor little rich girl who just has too much and wastes everything, squanders everything.
Well, Robert Cox, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
No, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. I mean, one agonizes about Argentina. It's still, you know, the point is, I mean, this is the basic thing. This government has not set out to deal with its enemies in the way that enemies have been dealt with in the past, whether it was under Perón when he came to power, and his was a popular dictatorship, and it's certainly not as under the military. People are not disappearing. We don't hear too much about torture. Life is frustrating there, but Argentina has the wherewithal to move ahead, to become a very civilized country. The economy, I don't think, unlike most people, I don't think the economy really is that important. The economy is something, it is so rich that eventually they can achieve a far more equal country, and I very much hope that will happen. We'll be returning in June or July for another 4 or 5 months there, and
well, I hope
that we will see that by that time the attitude in Argentina has turned.
There will be
an absolute commitment to democracy. That's what is needed, a real commitment to democracy.
Well, we'll stay in touch then, and I thank you very much for joining us, Robert
Cox. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure. It's always nice to talk about Argentina.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Cox, who's been called the hero of Argentine journalism, as the editor of the English language Buenos Aires Herald during the dirty wars of the 1970s and 1980s. He risked his life to report kidnappings, torture, and murder of thousands of Argentines by the military government. For his courage, Cox was awarded the Maria Moores Cabot Medal from Columbia University and was appointed Officer of the Order of the British Empire for services to international journalism. He is the subject of the book Dirty Secret, Dirty Wars, The Exile of Robert J. Cox, written by his son David Cox, and he is now a columnist with the Buenos Aires Herald. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer David Rosshert. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.